WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Bourne Supremacy, the sequel to the film The Bourne Identity, is out in theaters. On today's Fresh Air, an interview with Matt Damon, who stars in both as a CIA operative with amnesia. We'll also have a review of The Bourne Supremacy by film critic David Edelstein. And we bid farewell to two men of music, composer Jerry Goldsmith, who died Wednesday at the age of 75. He wrote the scores for the films Patton, Chinatown, and L.A. Confidential, as well as the TV show The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquette. He played in the big bands of Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie. Jacquette died yesterday. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush addressed the annual convention of the National Urban League today, urging members of the civil rights group to consider whether the African-American community is well served by its loyalty to Democrats.
Have the traditional solutions of the Democrat Party truly served the African-American community? That's what I hope people ask when they go to the community centers and places, as we all should do our duty and vote. People need to be asking these very serious questions.
The president said his tax cuts and education policies have helped African Americans. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry has launched a campaign tour that will culminate next week at his party's nominating convention in Boston. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Kerry began his approach to the Democratic convention in Colorado, where the Massachusetts senator was born during World War II. Kerry's father was an Army Air Corps pilot at the time, and Kerry says while he didn't spend much time in the state, less than 4 months, he's still proud to say he has some roots here in the West.
We're setting off on a journey that begins right here in my birthplace, and it's going to end in Boston, America's birthplace.
Before he arrives in Massachusetts next week, Kerry's pre-convention tour will also take him to the battleground states of Ohio, Florida, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. On Saturday, he'll campaign in Iowa, where his come-from-behind caucus victory 6 months ago reignited his presidential campaign. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Denver.
The Associated Press says newly released payroll records don't shed any new light on whether President Bush fulfilled his National Guard obligation. The records come from the summer of 1972, when Mr. Bush was working on a political campaign in Alabama. The AP says the records don't show whether Mr. Bush attended National Guard drills during that time. The Pentagon had said earlier that the records had been destroyed. A federal judge has blocked Mississippi from enforcing a law that would move some abortions from clinics to hospitals or other outpatient surgical centers. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The new law barred abortions at clinics starting at 13 weeks gestation. Previously, abortions have been allowed up to 16 weeks. The Jackson Women's Health Organization sued in June to have the new law declared unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Tom Lee said the new measure did nothing to protect patient health. The state contended the law was passed to move late-term abortions from clinics to facilities better equipped to ensure patient safety. But Simon Heller, an attorney with reproductive rights in New York, said an outpatient clinic without experience performing abortions is a poor choice compared to a clinic where abortions have been done for years. He also said the law would restrict access to abortion, forcing those seeking late-term procedures to go outside the state. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
The Dow lost 88 to 99.62. The Nasdaq lost 40 to 18.49. This is NPR News. Iraqi insurgents have kidnapped an Egyptian diplomat to back up their demand that the Egyptian government not provide any security aid to the interim Iraqi government. The militants made their demand in a video sent to the Al Jazeera television network. The kidnapping came after Egypt's government said it was prepared to send security experts to Iraq at the request of interim Iraqi leader Iyad Alawi. Lance Armstrong maintained his lead in the Tour de France today. The race has completed its fourth and final day in the French Alps. Adam Burke has more from Grenoble, France.
After three consecutive stage wins in the Alps, Armstrong finished with the main pack in today's stage, over 11 minutes behind a breakaway group. But neither stage winner Jose Mercado nor any of the other breakaway riders were a threat to Armstrong's overall lead in the race. The five-time Tour de France champion holds a 4-minute, 9-second lead over the second-place rider, Italian Ivan Basso. Barring an accident or injury over the next 2 days, Armstrong is set to become the only cyclist ever to win 6 Tour de France victories. Before heading to the finish line in Paris on Sunday, racers face a 37-mile individual time trial tomorrow in the city of Besançon. As a superior time trial cyclist, Armstrong could again increase his lead. For NPR News, I'm Adam Burke in Grenoble, France.
A city in Bosnia is celebrating the reconstruction of a 16th-century bridge that was destroyed during the Bosnian Civil War. The bridge was officially inaugurated today in Mostar, almost 11 years after it was knocked down by Bosnian-Croat artillery fire. The elegantly arched bridge was built during the Ottoman-Turkish Empire and served as a symbol of the city with its mixture of Christians and Muslims. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fine Living Television Network, from travel and design to golf, wine, and more, on TV and on the web at fineliving.com. Fine Living, live like you mean it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The trained assassin Jason Bourne has returned to the screen in The Bourne Supremacy, based on the spy novel by Robert Ludlum. It's the sequel to the 2002 espionage thriller, The Bourne Identity. Bourne is played by Matt Damon, one of the most popular actors of his generation. He starred in such films as Saving Private Ryan, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and Good Will Hunting, for which he also won an Oscar for the screenplay he wrote with his longtime friend, Ben Affleck. Terry Gross spoke with Matt Damon in 2002, when the first Bourne film was in theaters. In that film, Jason Bourne is adrift in the Mediterranean Sea, where he's rescued by fishermen. He has amnesia and has no recollection of what happened to him or who he is. The only clues are a couple of bullets in his back and a Swiss bank account number surgically implanted in his hip. He goes to the Swiss bank and finds his safe deposit box, which contains lots of cash, a gun, and several passports with his photo, but different names. In this scene, he's talking to a woman, played by Franca Potente, who's helping him find his way.
Who has a safety deposit box full of money and 6 passports and a gun? Who has a bank account number in their hip?
I come in here, and the first thing I'm doing is I'm catching the sight lines and looking for an exit.
I see the exit sign, too. I'm not worried. I mean, you were shot. People do all kinds of weird and amazing stuff when they're scared.
I can tell you the license plate numbers of all 6 cars outside. I can tell you that our waitress is left-handed and the guy sitting up at the counter weighs 215 pounds and knows how to handle himself. I know the best place to look for a gun is the cab of the gray truck outside. And at this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking. Now, why would I know that?
Dave trained in boxing and martial arts in preparation for his role as the buff and agile killer. But for an earlier role, he took a different approach.
You know, I read that for Courage Under Fire, when you had to lose weight, you not only starved yourself, but you used laxatives. Now, that can't be very healthy.
Actually, laxatives I used after I started eating again, because I did it unsupervised. And so all I was doing was I would run 13 miles every day, and I would eat chicken and egg whites and vegetables and 1 to 2 baked potatoes every day. For my carbohydrates. But I would run 6.5 miles in the morning and then 6.5 at night. And by the end of it, when my body really started kind of eating itself, like eventually your muscle just starts, you're consuming muscle at the end. There's no fat left really to consume. And I was just so tired. I just remember I would wake up in the morning, I would sit up in my bed. We were in Austin, Texas shooting, and I would immediately fall back over because I would get faint. So that was how I was working out at the end. I mean, it was stupid, and it was unsupervised, and I was low down on the totem pole. The studio wasn't going to spend $1,500 for me to have a trainer. I mean, But I also knew that it was a chance for me to get more work if I played the role. If I was honest and true in the role, then somebody would take notice. Anybody, you know.
Did Robert De Niro create this thing where, like, after Raging Bull, you had to put on weight or take off weight or physically change in some amazing way?
I'm sure he yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I grew up, you know, with that, seeing Raging Bull and loving that performance in that movie. And, you know, and I was 25 when I did Courage Under Fire, and it was, you know, the young man's kind of swagger and saying, look, you know, this is what I'm willing to do. This is what I'll put my body through. This is what, because the people that you really, you know, idolize did it too. And it's also this kind of weird, you know, living out in Los Angeles and not being able to get acting work, you know, it's a weird way of saying, you know, no matter what happens, nobody's ever going to tell me that there's anybody out here with more discipline or who will give up more for, you know, will sacrifice more for their job than me. And I don't
know.
What
would you get for it?
What's that?
What'd you get for it, for all the sacrifice?
Sick. I got sick. And, you know, eventually when I went back to Boston, yeah, the doctor put me on two different kinds of medication, and he said I'd really done some bad things to my body. He checked me out, and the first thing he said was, the only good thing I can tell you is that your heart didn't shrink.
Jeez.
And then he told
That's
me I could
option?
Never do it again.
Wow.
Yeah, well, it's your heart's a muscle, so if I'd kept up with it, you know, obviously that's what happens to people with anorexia, and, you know, eventually their bodies just shut down. So what my, you know, my big master plan of having people take notice, the movie came out and I was on this medication and the reviews for Courage Under Fire came out and none of them mentioned me at all. And that was when I just said, you know what, this is ridiculous, you know. But it was heartbreaking for me. It was really heartbreaking.
Now, you met Ben Affleck when you were about 10. Did he want to act, too? I mean, was the desire to act part of the basis of your friendship?
Definitely. Well, he was acting. He was known in Cambridge as the professional actor because he was on this PBS series called The Voyage of the Mimi, which was an educational TV show that was on PBS, and they use it as a tool in schools. And we lived two blocks from each other, but we really became friends in high school when he got to high school. So I was 15 or 16 when he got there, and he was 14, and then we fashioned a very, very deep bond, and a lot of it was based on what we both wanted to do. I mean, it's a weird thing looking back and going and meeting 16-year-olds or meeting 14-year-olds. He and I were flying to New York together at that age. Because my parents didn't support the idea that I would do this professionally at that age. They didn't say that I couldn't do it. They never did things like that. But they said they wouldn't pay for me to go to New York to audition for things. And so I did a local commercial in Boston. Ben and I went and got cast in a local commercial in Boston.
Wait, I'm going to interject. I think it was a TJ Maxx commercial.
Yeah, it was.
You get the Max for the minimum.
The Max for the minimum at TJ Maxx. And we got cut out of the commercial, but we still got paid.
Did you have to sing or try on coats or
no,
what?
I forget. I think we were sitting at a cafeteria table and a pretty girl walked by and we had to look at her and then look at each other like, isn't it great to be back in school or something like that. It was like a back-to-school ad.
Oh.
But we opened up a bank account and put the money in and we called it like, you know, our business bank account. But the money was four trips to New York for, you know, on the old Pan Am shuttle or on the train.
You ended up going to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Cambridge, so that wasn't far to go.
Right.
Far to go intellectually, but not geographically.
Right.
And then you left, I think, during or before your senior year?
Yeah.
To work?
Yeah, I left a few times. I left in the beginning, the second semester of my sophomore year to do a TNT movie. And then I came back and then left to do School Ties. And then came back again, and then left to do a movie called Geronimo. Geronimo.
I'm one of the few people who saw that.
Oh, you're the one. Yeah. which was a great experience.
Walter Hill.
Yeah. And that was a great experience. I mean, I got to work with Duvall and, you know, Gene Hackman. I didn't really get to work with Gene Hackman, but, you know, I shook his hand and I said, he said, what's your name? And I said, Matt Damon. He said, Mark, great to meet you.
Matt Damon speaking with Terry Gross. He plays the trained assassin Jason Bourne in the new film, The Bourne Supremacy. We'll continue after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Matt Damon. In 1998, Damon and his longtime friend Ben Affleck won an Oscar for their screenplay For Good Will Hunting. Damon was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the film as Will, a young man from South Boston who works as a janitor at Harvard, but is able to solve seemingly unsolvable math problems left on a blackboard. Will grew up in foster homes and has a rap sheet. When he's jailed for instigating a fight, a professor who sees Will's genius bails him out, on the condition that he gets some counseling. Will's psychologist is played by Robin Williams. In this scene, Will is in the psychologist's office when a painting catches his eye, a painting made by the psychologist.
The linear and impressionistic mix makes a very muddled composition. It's also a Winslow Homer ripoff, except you got Whitey rowing a boat there.
Well, it's an odd one, eh? It wasn't very good.
That's not really what concerns me, though.
What concerns you?
It's the coloring.
You know what the real bitch of it is? It's paint by number.
Is it color by number? Because the colors are fascinating to me.
Are they really? What about that?
I think you're about one step away from cutting your f***ing ear off.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think I should move to the south of France, change my name to Vincent.
You ever heard the saying, any port in a storm?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that means you.
In what way?
Maybe you're in the middle of a storm, a big f***ing storm.
Yeah.
The sky's falling on your head, the waves are crashing over your little boat. The oars are about to snap. You're just pissing your pants, you're crying for the harbor, so maybe you do what you gotta do to get out. You know, maybe you became a psychologist.
Bingo. That's it. Let me do my job now. You start with me. Come on.
Maybe you married the wrong woman.
Maybe you should watch your mouth. Watch it right there, Chief, all right?
That's it, isn't it? You married the wrong woman? What happened? Why'd she leave you? Was she, you know, banging some other guy?
If you ever disrespect my wife again, I will end you. I will f***ing end you.
Let's get to Good Will Hunting. The movie, I think, is based on a play that you wrote when you were still a student at Harvard. What was the original play like?
I wrote it, actually. It was a playwriting course that this guy, Anthony Kubiak, taught at Harvard, which is a terrific course. And I wrote it as a screenplay, you know, in screenplay format. And the original one was 41 pages long, and it just had the beginnings of a story. And it had... From what survived of it was the one scene that survived from that was the first time that I meet Robin Williams' character in that movie, when he eventually grabs me by the neck and throws me up against the wall because I say something about his wife, and that scene was verbatim as I wrote in Anthony Kubiak's class, but nothing else survived, but he encouraged me. The teacher encouraged me when I finished the class. He gave me an A, and it was the first, you know, one of the first times I got an A at Harvard, and I didn't care what I got in the class. I had such a good time in the class, and he gave me an A, and next to it, he wrote on the paper, he wrote, you know, you should really keep going with this. This really seems like it could be leading somewhere, and encouraged me to do it. And so a few months later, for spring break, I went to Los Angeles to audition, actually for Geronimo, an American legend, and stayed with Ben and brought the, you know, work in progress thing with me and showed him, and he loved it. And he said, this is great. We should do something with this. And so we agreed, you know, neither of us knew which way to go with it though. So, a little later on, I did Geronimo and then moved in. Ben and I got a place in LA with Casey, his brother. And, we were there for like a year before, you know, and this thing was just sitting on the shelf 'cause neither of us could think of what to do. And then one night we were literally sitting around talking It was probably 1 a.m, and it just started. I think Ben was the first one. He started saying something, and the way that the things normally work with us is one person says a little thing, the next person, and it just starts to rapidly, which is why, you know, we're utterly useless without each other. At least we have been so far. But it happened really, and it kind of tumbled out, and the script came really, really quickly.
I want to ask you about the talent in Mr. Ripley. You were really just terrific in that film. And you're playing somebody who doesn't have any of the things he wants. Friends, a lover, interesting work, interesting life, travel, money,
right.
None of that. And through a little bit of deception, or perhaps a lot of deception, he's able to kind of change his life and become part of this, like, charmed circle of wealthy people.
Right.
Revolving particularly around this one couple played by Jude Law and
right.
Gwyneth Paltrow. And the first time you meet them, you're meeting them, is it in Italy?
Yeah.
And you're on the Mediterranean on a beach, and they're all, like, bronzed and beautiful, and you've just arrived from
New York City.
Yeah, and you're pale and kind of scrawny. This is one of the
right.
roles you lost weight for. And the first time you meet them, you're in your bathing suit, and you just look so wrong.
Right.
You look so out of place. And it sets the tone beautifully for everything that's to follow, this physically uncomfortable, out-of-the-place, wrong-looking person. Can you talk a little bit just about that scene, even?
Yeah, it was just right. I mean, it was right there in the script when I read it, and it made total sense. And we wanted, obviously, when Ripley starts to try to take over Dickie's identity, for him to try to look more and more like him. So the bigger gap you can leave at the beginning, the better that's going to come across. And also, we just love the awkwardness of it. The green bathing suit that I wore was, you know, maybe a little bit kind of over the top. There was a scene, though, that Anthony had. Anthony Minghella scripted, just in case he felt we needed it, where they show me buying the bathing suit. I see him on the beach, and so I buy the bathing suit, and that's the only one they have, which is how I ended up with that bathing suit, just in case it seemed too kind of goofy that I would have a lime green, you know, bathing suit. But, you know, Anthony looked at the movie and didn't feel like we needed it. And so there's Ripley kind of showing up as pale. I mean, they painted me alabaster for that.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You got painted pale.
Yeah, and I already was pale. I had stayed out of the sun for, you know, months and months, and I was as pale as I could be. But they you know, even put more kind of gook all over me.
What did you do internally to get into the character of somebody who wants so desperately to live this life that he has no access to, that he finally ends up not only deceiving but killing for it?
It's just that I can really relate. I really related to that character in a lot of ways. I really related to that.
In what way?
I don't know. I've had that feeling, you know, in my life of wanting to belong somewhere and not belonging, and especially kind of in, you know, adolescence and teenage years. I mean, those are, you feel that with such pain, and, you know.
Yeah, but you already had an agent in New York.
Yeah, right, that's
you
right.
You brag about to your friends.
Yeah, God. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot to him, that to that character that I just really related to and loved, I still feel bad for that character. I got really mad the first time I saw the movie, actually, with the final music, because there was a scene where I'm walking at Gwyneth and I have a razor in my pocket, and the music that, you know, which it's perfect for the movie, it's right for the movie, but because Anthony was my kind of, you know, partner in crime, that the whole time we were shooting it, every time something, you know, we would ask something, you know, we'd say, well, should Ripley, I mean, I'd say, so I'm going to kill Freddy with this statue? And he'd go, of course you're going to kill Freddy. Freddy's coming into your house. Freddy is accusing you of doing it. How dare he? He has a lot of nerve. You know, he was very much my ally, you know, when we were shooting it, because that was what got me ready for every scene, was the fact that what I'm doing makes total sense. This is, of course I'm going to do this, and this makes, you know. So Anthony was a very good kind of sounding board for the Ripley rationale. But of course, at the end of the day, he's the director of the movie. So when he goes to put the music over the scene where I'm walking towards Gwyneth with a razor blade, he's not defending Ripley. He's got this kind of Hitchcockian music over it. And so when I saw it, I was like, you know, how, you know.
He told me I was justified.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you? You're supposed to be my friend.
What was it like for you when you first became, when you first started acting in movies with big stars in it, and then you became a big star yourself, and suddenly all the people who you admired when you were young, who seemed so out of reach, who lived either in the television box or on the big screen, were colleagues of yours or friends of yours or people you had access to. Was it awkward at first to be in that circle, to be in that situation where people who were always just these like movie figures were now actually three-dimensional people and you were working with them or you were talking with them?
Yeah, that was weird. I mean, the only time I really run into other people, you know, that I've grown up watching or whatever is at like a ceremony or, you know, an event or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't really run into too many people, although I have an assistant, and I guess, you know, for two years ago for Christmas, I guess I have a habit of talking about Morgan Freeman a lot because I really respect Morgan
Freeman. Oh, he's
great,
yeah.
And so for, this is going to sound really silly, but for Christmas a couple of years ago, she gave me as a Christmas gift dinner with Morgan Freeman. She called Morgan Freeman's assistant, and I guess he thought it was funny, and so they kind of agreed, and it was like a, you know, make-a-wish dinner or something where I was like Chris Farley on the old Chris Farley show on Saturday Night Live. Like, remember that time in that movie when you did that thing? That was awesome. But for the most part, the most I get to know people is working with them. And I've been incredibly lucky to, starting with, back with Duvall, and how good he was to me and how and he didn't have to do that, and the guy is a living legend, you know, and he tolerated my questions, and I did Courage Under Fire with Denzel Washington, and he was really nice to me, and Rainmaker, I mean, God damn, Danny DeVito, Mickey Rourke was great to me. Mickey Rourke sat me down the first time I met him kind of forcefully and said, don't screw this up, don't do what I did. I was a jerk to people, I you know. Right. He said, you appreciate what you have and be polite to everybody you meet and don't ever screw this up. It was pretty, you know, affecting.
Matt Damon, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for having me.
Matt Damon speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He stars as the trained assassin Jason Bourne in the new film The Bourne Supremacy, based on the thriller by Robert Ludlum. We'll hear what our film critic David Edelstein thinks about the film later in today's show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Dial Press, publisher of The Summer Guest, a novel of love, family secrets, and a dying man's wish by Justin Cronin, author of the collection Mary and O'Neill. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The score from L.A. Confidential, composed by Jerry Goldsmith, who died Wednesday. Coming up, we'll listen back to an interview with Goldsmith, who won an Oscar and five Emmys for his work in film and television. Also, we remember tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquet, who died yesterday. And David Edelstein reviews The Bourne Supremacy. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
The tragedy and the romance which filled the screen in Chinatown wouldn't have been the same without the lush, dark score by Jerry Goldsmith.
All right, come on, clear the area. On the sidewalk. On the sidewalk. Get off the street.
Composer Jerry Goldsmith died on Wednesday at his home in Beverly Hills. He was 75. Goldsmith was one of the most prolific composers for film and television. His film scores included Chinatown, Patton, Star Trek, Alien, The Sand Pebbles, A Patch of Blue, the original Planet of the Apes, and L.A. Confidential. He also wrote the TV themes for The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Dr. Kildare, The Waltons, and Barnaby Jones. His 1976 score for The Omen won an Oscar. He received another 17 Academy Award nominations and 5 Emmy Awards. Terry spoke with Jerry Goldsmith in 2002. They opened with his score from Patton, the World War II movie starring George C. Scott as General George Patton.
People talk about Patton as a war film. I never viewed it as a war film. I viewed it as a personal documentary or biography of a man who was a warrior, yes, but there were two other aspects of him, which I did capture in the music. He was a very religious man, in spite of his profane personality, and he was also a total intellectual and a deep believer in reincarnation and history, and he spoke fluent French. He was cultured in musically. I mean, the dichotomy of the man, and you know how profane he was, but yet there was this depth of. So he was a complex personality, and I tried capturing these three levels of his personality in music by the fanfare, which has become sort of well known, is meant to represent the archaic part of him, the historical, the intellectual part of him. The chorale was to represent the religious aspect of him, and of course the military aspect, and it was designed contrapuntally so that all three could be played simultaneously or individually or two at a time, whatever.
Now, you've written the themes for several TV shows. Dr. Kildare, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., both of those are on your new CD.
The Waltons.
The Waltons. Why don't we hear the theme that you wrote for The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Okay.
Anything you want to say about it?
I guess during the 60s, late 50s and 60s, we all had to be versatile, so we had to have jazz influence in our music, and so that was what I sort of tried to do. But to make it more interesting, I originally wrote it in 5/4, which, except for Dave Brubeck, was not really a meter that was particularly common in jazz. And an interesting side note of this whole thing is after the first season, they wanted to save money, and I had written it for a larger group, like it was 20 players, and they wanted to cut it down to a little, like 4 or 5 piece, because you had to pay each year to re-record the theme. So they wanted to save money, so I was unavailable, so they hired Lalo Schifrin, and Lalo did a very hip arrangement of it for a small group, and that's really what they used for the years. However long the show was on the air, it was Lalo's arrangement of the theme.
Now, I want to talk about another theme that you wrote, and that's the theme for Chinatown, which I think is really just one of the great scores. Let's talk about the opening theme.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific part of the movie or a specific emotion within the movie that you wanted that opening theme to evoke or address?
The story was that the picture had been recorded before by scored by someone else before, and then they previewed it. And actually, the previews in the picture were evidently, from what I was told, were not very successful. And the music was not very good either. I mean, I must say that when I did see the picture, I had heard a little of the music, and it was Chinese. So it seemed rather inappropriate for the film. So anyway, so I was called in to do it, and I had to do the score in 10 days, which was a very short period of time to do it. And the producer, Robert Evans, had said to me, we should have a period feel in the music, period feel being the style of the 30s. And I said, well, you've got that in this Bunny Berrigan recording you're using. Is, you know, it's coming off the radio and all that. And you see that in the cinematography and the costumes, the wardrobe, and the whole feel, the look of the picture was 30s Los Angeles. And I grew up, I was here as a young kid in the 30s. I know what it looked like and felt like. And that was the amazing thing about this picture. It was that feel was so true. I said, so musically, I want to try and go for the tragedy of the story. I finished recording it, and the movie came out like 3 days later, so we were really right down to the wire on it. So I didn't have a lot of time to think. I just had to sit down and write a theme for this movie and get on with it.
Film composer Jerry Goldsmith died on Wednesday at the age of 75. Our conversation with him was recorded in 2002. Coming up, we remember another great musical figure, saxophonist Illinois Jacquette, who died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. Tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquette died yesterday at the age of 81 at his home in Queens. He spent his life playing jazz, but his honking tenor saxophone solos inspired many rhythm and blues and rock and roll tenor players. Jean-Baptiste Illinois Jacquette was born in Louisiana to an American Indian mother and a French Creole father. His jazz career dated back to early childhood when he sang and danced in his father's big bands. In the 40s, he played in bands led by Lionel Hampton, Cab Calloway, and Count Basie, and played in the Jazz at the Philharmonic tours. He formed his own big band in 1983 after several decades playing in small groups. Just 2 months ago, Jacquet received an honorary doctorate of musical arts from the Juilliard School of Music. When Terry spoke to him in 1988, they opened with this music. It was his first American release in nearly two decades.
Putting together your big band, what configuration of horns and saxophones did you know you want, and what kind of thought went into that, deciding how many of each there'd be?
Well, see, I knew what I wanted before I even organized the band. I knew how it should sound, and five saxophones, which Count Basie had when I was in the band, and four trumpets, and three or four trombones, and a full rhythm section with piano, bass, and drums. And so I knew all about what a big band should be. I like harmony. I like trombones. I like trumpets. I like saxophones. I like rhythm sections.
And good arrangements.
And the best arrangements, you know. You can do a lot. You can play soft and whisper with a big band because you can have arrangements that are so beautiful until you forget about how the size of the band.
Well, let me give an example of what you're talking about. On the new record, you have a beautiful version of More Than You Know, and it's you play beautifully on that with the band behind you. Ask you some things about your past. Your grandfather was a musician, and you sang and danced in your father's big band. How did your father feel about bringing you into clubs when you were just a child and exposing you to alcohol and to the club scene? Was he at all uncomfortable about that?
No, not at all. My mother and father, they loved music, and all three of my brothers played music. All my two sisters sang and danced. And I was the baby, and wherever they went, I went. And they knew that I had the talent. They knew I was going to do something. So there was no stopping me from doing anything.
After high school, you moved to Los Angeles, and you hooked up with Lionel Hampton there. You were introduced to Hampton by Nat Cole?
Yes. He jammed with the King Cole Trio, and I was as an invited guest along with him. And that's when I met him, and he heard me, and we really had a jam session that, you know, Hamp loves to play, and that everybody just loves to play, and I love to play. So we played, and he called me over and asked me what I'd like to join his band. He was forming a band. So he asked me would I mind switching from the alto saxophone to the tenor saxophone.
Why did he want you to switch?
Well, he figured that the style that I was doing on the alto saxophone, if I would play it on the tenor, it would be more effective for his band. And I had to think about that. That was quite a decision to make. But if I wanted to join a named band, this was my chance, and that's why I switched.
So what was it like the first time you picked up the tenor saxophone?
Well, the first time I picked up the tenor saxophone, I sounded like Lester Young because that's what I heard out of that horn. And I kept playing different styles of Coleman Hawkins a little here and a little bit of Don Byers, Ben Webster, and some of the greats. You know, I always listen to the musicians, you know, the ones that really can play, you know, and they are your greatest teachers when you're learning how to play. So I could play like all the greats, but I had no style of my own, see, and you have to create something for your own if you want to last in this business. So when we got ready to record, to make my first record, now I was in trouble, see, because now what I'm going to do for myself, I had to talk to myself, and that was the trap that I was in. And Marshall Rawl, who was the first saxophone player in my Hampton band, a great musician and a great saxophonist, he knew that I could play like everybody. And just as I got up to go to the mic, he whispered in my ear, say, "Go for yourself." I said, "Go for myself." And as I was walking up to the microphone, that's when I created this solo on Flying Home, May the 26th, 1942, on Decca Records.
Age 19 when you made that record.
Yes.
How did your recording of Flying Home change your life? People started noticing you.
Well, no one could follow that song when we played. None of the acts could come on behind that. The show was over every night. I remember when engagement we played at the Golden Gate Theater, and the people got so carried away with this solo until you could see the balcony about to cave in from the stage. You could see it. It created excitement that you could never believe. You'd have to be there and be playing it to realize what was happening. And it was all me. And it just changed my whole life into knowing and gave me the confidence that I had to take care of myself and I had to really continue to do things in music that I never believed that I could do.
You've played with a lot of great band leaders. You've played with Lionel Hampton, Count Basie, with Cab Calloway. You grew up playing with your father. What kind of band leader are you? And have you taken any of your cues from the band leaders who you've played with?
Yes. Well, in my father's band, the discipline was there. And I learned that from him. That timing was very essential. Without time, without making time, you're gonna play like that. And when I joined the Hampton Band, I learned about the excitement, that the showmanship that Hampton, he's a great showman along with his talent. And when I joined the Cavs Band, I learned how to discipline yourself to dress. Cap was one of the best dress leaders that you could want to see on the stage. He had special clothes and special shoes, and it was everything out there. And I learned from that. When I joined the Count Basie band, I learned the discipline of calling a set. Programming your music, take a big band and make it whisper. So when you came to the excitement, it would be an explosion of music. So I mold all that into my being in front of my big band, and I am so happy to be in front of this band. I've never been as happy as I am now.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquet speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. He died yesterday at the age of 81 from a heart attack. Coming up, a review of The Bourne Supremacy. This is Fresh Air. The Bourne Supremacy is the second in a series of thrillers by Robert Ludlum featuring the amnesiac CIA assassin Jason Bourne. The first in the series, The Bourne Identity, was turned into a 2002 hit movie starring Matt Damon. Damon is back for the sequel, which also features Joan Allen and Brian Cox. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
6 months after 9/11, it was weirdly comforting to see The Bourne Identity. It was based on a 22-year-old novel by Robert Ludlum, and it took us back to a Cold War era when the only people who ever seemed to die were spies and counter-spies and the occasional overweening party apparatchik. Matt Damon played a guy found floating off the coast of Marseille with two bullets in his back and the number of a Zurich safe deposit box in some sort of laser body implant. He had no idea who he was, but he had somehow retained his lightning martial arts reflexes, his fluency in a handful of languages, and the instincts of a super spy assassin. It was pretty silly stuff, but the film, directed by Doug Liman, was fast, adroit, and like its hero, wonderfully self-contained. The sequel, The Bourne Supremacy, is better. Not better as a story, that's if anything even sillier. Better as a piece of grab-you-by-the-collar-and-fling-you-all-over-the-place filmmaking. If you'll pardon my French, it's a tour de force. The English director, Paul Greengrass, made the amazing 2002 movie Bloody Sunday. I almost said the amazing documentary, because that film about the Irish Civil Rights March of 1972 that ended in a massacre was staged and shot like combat photography. You weren't watching a recreation. You were right there in the middle of the melee. And Greengrass brings the same verite technique to the patently fictional Bourne Supremacy. He puts you in the street with Jason Bourne, scanning a crowd that streaks by so fast that your eyes don't quite focus. You only half catch the guy with the rifle taking aim before the bullet explodes and the world is upended. The movie has hand-to-hand fight scenes so close and blurry and tumultuous that they summon up your fight-or-flight instincts. It's like the filmmaker is thinking on his feet with his hero, moving fast so he won't miss something, and making you keep up, or else. You don't even want to look down at your popcorn. Better yet, you don't have time to think too much about the plot. When the film begins, Bourne is in India, still in hiding, still with Marie, the love of his life, played by Franca Potente, still trying to piece together his memories, especially the memory of a mission, maybe in Berlin, with two people dead. Why does it gnaw at him? Maybe for the same reason someone has framed him for the murder of a couple of spies and is now trying to shoot him. After he takes an agonizing leave of Marie, Bourne heads for Berlin, where CIA agent Pamela Landy, played by Joan Allen, leads a team in pursuit. A step ahead by reflex, Bourne manages to corner Julia Stiles as a minor and surprisingly unsympathetic functionary. You have to picture Damon and Stiles weaving in and out of crowds and agents with headphones and the editing electric and the camera swerving all over the place.
What were my words? What did I say? Is it leave me alone?
I did. I swear, Jason, I told them that I believed you.
I'm going to ask you some simple questions.
Delta, give me something. I need something.
They're on it.
Who's Pamela Landy?
She's a task force chief.
Is she running Treadstone?
No, she's the deputy director.
Why is she trying to kill me?
Last week, an agency field officer tried to make a buy-off of one of her ops. He was trying to sell out a mole or something.
And
you got to him before we did.
I killed him.
You left a print. There were partial prints that traced back to Treadstone. They know it was you.
That is insane.
Why are you doing this? Why come back now?
Stop. Last week, I was 4,000 miles away in India. They came for me. This ends now.
The Bourne Supremacy improves on its predecessor by telling two stories. It's not just Bourne running away from police and assassins and people in headquarters screaming, "Get Bourne!" Although there is a lot of that, come to think of it. There's also Joan Allen's Landy trying to figure out why so many of her higher-ups want to kill Bourne before he can talk to anyone. Poor Bourne doesn't know what's going on, and Damon manages to play befuddlement without the slightest loss of virility. Impassive as he is, you can always see the wheels turning in his head. He turns the gap between his plodding demeanor and those automatic quicksilver reflexes into something witty and moving, even existential. But in the end, the movie is a testament to the director's virtuosity and to how video and documentary techniques can transform even the most familiar material into something with astonishing immediacy. Freed from the old-fashioned studio gloss, The Bourne Supremacy makes the Cold War thriller seem born again.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, world-renowned architect Frank Gehry. His latest design is Chicago's Millennium Park. Also, stand-up comic Patton Oswalt tells us about being booed off stage by liberals and conservatives alike. He co-stars in the sitcom The King of Queens and is a regular on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Join us for the next Fresh Air.